Hey friends, just a quick note to say how much we appreciate any donations to Health Freedom for Humanity. We pride ourselves on being low overhead, so any money you donate goes directly to the very things that are active in the fight for freedom. Things like the website, administrative costs, and small salaries for those that are coordinating the work. In the future, we look forward to setting up local chapters in each state and being more activist-driven while still giving you the content you need to stay informed. Simply go to healthfreedomforhumanity.org/donate and give to your heart's content. Thank you so much for your participation.
And welcome back to another episode of Health Freedom for Humanity's newest podcast series, Voices of the Victims. In this episode, I interview Rebecca Schauer, who sadly lost her father, Robert Campbell, last year during his hospitalization with COVID. We have a discussion which leads me to ask this very important question. Why are hospitals around the world continuing to use very dangerous treatments and protocols like remdesivir and ventilators to treat patients when we know that they have not been working? And there are other treatment options out there that have been proven to work. Rebecca explains to us what went on in this hospital, including some negligence that her father went through and ultimately may have led to his death in the end. Let's hear what Rebecca has to say. And if you feel that someone would benefit from watching this episode, please do share with your family and friends, because it's important that we continue to have conversations like this so others out there know that they're not the only one and people continue to connect the dots. Hi, Rebecca. Thank you so much for joining us today. You know, I think out of all the episodes that we do and stories that we share, I think it's always difficult to have conversations with people who've been injured by the vaccine. But when you have conversations with people who've lost a loved one, it really touches me in a way. Having lost both my parents, I can empathize with you and your story. Now, for the listeners at home, you've lost your father, Robert Campbell, after taking one of these vaccines this year, correct? No. Please enlighten me.
He passed away last year after his battle with COVID and taking remdesivir.
Oh, so your father was actually a COVID remdesivir case. My apologies. I mean, either way, last year with everything going on with the stuff that's going on in the hospital, we know that the protocols that they put in place were killing a lot of people. Unfortunately, I lost my mother last year as well. So I know how important stories like this are to this whole narrative of everything that's going on. So please do share with us your father's story and how all of this unfolded for you.
Yes. Well, so last summer, my husband left for a deployment, and right after I started feeling kind of not so well, and I had a feeling I knew what it was, but it was pretty mild. And my dad was helping me, bring me vitamins and different things like that. And at one point, my mom mentioned to me that he wasn't feeling well either. And I know that I had just traveled and he had just had a stent put in his heart in the hospital, both during the week prior. So we figured that one of us got it and gave it to the other, because we always spend a ton of time together. He spent a lot of time with my kids and coming over to the house. So we just thought, we just shared it. And he was a Vietnam veteran, and so he had dealt with the effects of Agent Orange, blood clots in his lungs, severe PTSD. And we always knew that if he got COVID, he would probably struggle a little more than just anyone else. But he had been through so much. He was just turned 74. And when I was little, he was in the hospital months at a time, walking with in a wheelchair or with a cane. And he got to the point where he was running around with my kids. He was doing really well, overall very healthy. So we thought he might struggle, but we figured he would be okay. And my mom told me that he was experiencing some GI symptoms and fatigue. And then during the next week, I was struggling because I had three kids. At the time, they were 5, 3, and 1. And so with my husband gone, with me just having no energy to do anything, and my dad seemingly doing fine. He just seemed more tired, some GI symptoms, and we figured he would rest and might take a while to get through, but he'd be okay. So my mom made the decision to come and stay with me, figuring it'd be 3 or 4 days, maybe a week. They lived in the same town, but just to help me with the kids so I could actually rest and get better. And so him and I both ended up getting tested and tested positive. My goal was to be able to get budesonide prescribed because I noticed I had a little cough and I had struggled with asthma. And I figured, you know, that seems like the best answer to help me with that. And also my dad, after he got tested, they refused to give him anything, just said, come back to the ER when you can't breathe. So I figured if I could get it, I could also give it to him. And because he had taken it before for other things. So it wasn't anything that would have been unsafe for him. Right. And so the doctor that saw me gave me a prescription for it. And I took it and it helped. I ended up sending it over to him because it, by that time he was starting to struggle with just the fatigue, the exhaustion, the low oxygen levels. We had ordered some food delivery, grocery delivery for him for easy microwave meals or just because he wasn't eating because he had no energy to cook. Mm-hmm. So we tried to order a bunch of stuff that he loved that would be really easy for him to just grab and go. Sent him over a pulse ox monitor and the nebulizer with the budesonide. And my sister is in Missouri. And my mom was at my house. And so we all took turns calling him, checking on him. And overall, I was doing okay. Most of my energy during the day was spent either calling my dad and checking up on him or and arranging for him to get supplies or to help my mom with the kids. And my mom was wonderful, helping me a ton. But then it got to the point where my sister called me. She said, I just talked to dad. I think you need to call him. I don't think he's doing so well. And so I gave him a call and I said, how are you feeling? He said, not very good. Said, very tired. I feel like it's a little bit hard to breathe. And I said, have you had any budesonide? He said, no. So I sat on the phone while he took the treatment. Before he did, I had him test his oxygen and it was around 86, 87 on the pulse ox.
Wow.
Took the budesonide and it went to 88 or 89. And he was sitting with his feet up. I'm like, okay, it's better. I said, but it's low and I think you need to go to the hospital. I said, the very least for them to check you out, maybe they'll just send you home with some oxygen. I said, but you've had enough health issues. Like, this is something you need to do. He said, no, I'm not doing that. He had a lot of PTSD from time in the hospital over the years. A lot of malpractice happened to him, a lot of very scary things. And so the hospital was not a safe place for him. He never felt safe going. And so I said, well, would you be willing to call the Nurse Advice Line? At least call, see what they say, and see if they think that you should go in or if you're okay waiting a little longer. And he was willing to call. So he called and he called me back. I said, what'd they say? And they said, or he's like, they told me I need to go. And I said, I told you. And he said, I don't want to go. The dad, if you don't go, I'm going to call an ambulance. And he hummed and hawed and fought against me. My sister and my mom were in contact with one of his neighbors and they offered to drive him. And he said that he wasn't going to have anyone drive. He was going to drive his own truck. So his truck would be at the hospital. So he had a way to get home. And I said, okay. I said, but he's going to follow you. He said, no. No, he's going to follow you. Like, we want to make sure you're safe. Your oxygen is low. The last thing we need is for you to have trouble when you're driving. He put me on speakerphone. I had him grab a book and a phone charger. And he got in his truck and he left. And I was on speakerphone with him the entire time he drove to the hospital. It was only 10 or 15 minutes. And he pulled up at the hospital and he said, I don't want to go inside. And I said, what do you mean? I'm like, you've gotten this far. He said, if I go inside, I'm not going to come out again. And I said, you don't know that. I said, you're going in just checked out to get some oxygen. You're not going in an ambulance. This isn't, you know, a life or death thing right now. Like I said, but if you don't, it could be that. You can't survive with your oxygen in the 80s, especially with the lung damage you have.
Right.
And he was very hesitant. And I said, please, Dad, will you go in? We just want to make sure you're healthy. And he said, okay. So he's walking in and walked up to the check-in desk. And he said, I have to go. And he hung up. And then I didn't hear anything from him for a couple hours. He texted me and said he was in a triage room waiting. And a couple hours later, he called me and said that they are admitting him for oxygen support. And he had the nasal cannula. He said his oxygen was already up in the low 90s. But they're going to admit him to the COVID unit just to keep that support for a while. And I was able to talk to the ER doctor. And he was not a very kind person. I started asking him, you know, like, how they thought he was doing, if, you know, more details about how long they thought he'd be on oxygen, if he was going to need any other treatments, how long they thought he might be in there, like what was their goal and their plan. And he told me that I needed to, without me saying anything, that I've read this, I've researched, it's just asking basic questions. He said, I need to get off Facebook because it's people like me that are killing others.
Wow.
Because I won't let doctors be doctors. And I ask too many questions when I know nothing about what's going on.
Wow.
And so I was like, okay. And I just kind of let that go. And I knew he was the ER doctor. He wouldn't be his permanent doctor. So later that evening, once they got to a room in the COVID unit, the night shift hospitalist for the COVID unit called me, much kinder. He brought up remdesivir right away. And he said, I think your dad is a perfect candidate in the age range. He's not doing terrible. We think that, you know, this could benefit him. And I said, I'm not sure. Like, I know that there was studies on it that were pulled back because it wasn't performing the way these studies were claiming. And he said, well, I have to apply for it. It might take a few days. So you can think about it, talk to your family about it. And, you know, if we get approval, then we can kind of move forward. And my dad had put me down, ended up adding my sister as well, but that I could talk to them, and then ended up making it so I was the main point of contact for the doctor. Because for months, my husband and I had been reading everything about it. We watched The High Wire, different podcasts, reading every article that came out, just trying to understand. So we knew a lot more of the lingo and the language and treatment options of all different kinds. And I had been with my dad to the doctor many times. So I knew his medical history, you know, not as well as my mom did, but very close to it. And so my mom was dealing with my kids. And, you know, she said, I just get so stressed and I don't really understand about everything they're saying. So between my sister and I, she works in a medical office, we kind of went back and forth with the nurses and doctors. And so I was the one the doctor would call every day for an update. My sister and I would take turns with calling the nurses different times throughout the day, with different shifts, checking on his vitals and checking on his labs and how he was doing and just everything that we could ask. He did have some really great nurses. We had certain favorites of different shifts that were just overwhelmingly helpful, understanding that we couldn't be there and that we were the type of family that we wanted to know everything that was going on and have everything answered that we could, and that we were knowledgeable. We weren't going to just let, you know, he's doing okay, kind of be it, be the answer.
At that point, what was your knowledge about remdesivir?
At the time, I didn't know a ton. It was something that I knew, like I said before, that they had pulled the one study back because the claims it made weren't correct. But I figured that they pulled that back and that was kind of going to be the end of that push, that it was, I think at the time, as far as I knew, that it wasn't something that they were really pushing on a lot of people. They used on some, but it wasn't this big push that this is what everybody gets. And it was, I knew it was expensive. They had to go through an application process to give it. And so I thought, you know, when I asked the doctor, he called and he said, you know, he got approved. And I said, well, what are the risks? He said, I don't really know the risks. I know there's a bunch of different treatment options. I said, but with this, I just know that it doesn't work like it claimed. He said that he had seen it do some good, and but he hadn't seen it do any bad. And that there, he said the worst that it could do was nothing. So we give it to him and he doesn't improve. But he said, there's not going to be any other risks. There's not going to be anything you need to worry about with it. Mm-hmm. And I asked, I said, what about hydroxychloroquine? And he said, no, absolutely not. And I said, why not? He says, against hospital policy. And in my opinion, it should be illegal because it's too dangerous. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay. I said, but if he wants it and we want it and we're okay with the risk and we sign off on that. And he said, no, he said, I won't allow it. And during this time, my mom started not feeling well, and my niece drove down from Missouri to come help me with the kids and with my mom and everything going on. And my mom ended up going home testing positive, and her doctor prescribed her hydroxychloroquine. So I told my dad's doctor, I said, well, my mom has it, and you know, her doctor's confident that it'll be fine. And he mumbled under his breath something along the lines of, you know, that's a scary risk that she's taking. But he was just kind of very straightforward that we're going to do remdesivir, has no risks. And at the time, I didn't know any better. And I think that's one of my biggest, looking back, the more that comes out about it, it's like one of my biggest thing I have the most guilt about, because it was my call. My dad didn't know anything. My mom didn't know anything. My sister didn't really. And it was just my husband and I that were the most knowledgeable. And with his reassurances several times that he said, there's no risk. It's either going to help or it's just going to do nothing. I said, okay.
Right.
I said, if you're not willing to give anything else, then we have to try. So.
It's you can't feel guilt over something that, you know, you weren't really that all familiar with. When you have, when you have a medical professional whose job it is to have all of the right information, if they're giving medication to a patient, we trust that they're giving us the truth, and that they have all of the answers, and that they've looked at the studies and they know the risks. Mm-hmm. You know, and we make our judgments and our decisions based on the best available information that we have. And that's what you did.
Right.
You trusted this doctor.
I did. And I have always had hesitancy with medical professionals, just because of the past experiences I've had, my dad's had, in just all different manners. But at the end of the day, I figured, you know, maybe they're doing things they shouldn't, and there's some really bad ones out there, but there's no way that a doctor is going to tell me that there's no risk. I think what they're saying about hydroxychloroquine, really, and just more of a political thing and a policy thing and not a healthcare thing. But I said, if they're telling me that there's no risk, then it would be silly for me to not try. But they're also saying that they've seen some good come of it. And I said, I told my husband that I would have felt bad that if it started getting worse and then he was out of the time frame that they said that it could have worked, that why didn't I just try? There was no risk. So that's what I go back to. But it's definitely, I know I can't take on the guilt myself, but it's definitely something that I wish that we would have known more of what we know now about it than.
Right. So at what point, when did you make your decision? And
so he was doing overall okay. He was struggling. He wasn't getting better. He was getting worse, but we figured, based on the pattern that I was showing from it, and people that we've known and what we knew about it, that, you kind of don't do so good. And then there's a time period where it's like really bad for a little while and then you start to do better. And we thought that he was kind of in that period. And the doctor agreed that he was in the period where he was struggling a bit more. And that's the critical point where we need to make good decisions so that we can get him to come out of that and then he would be fine. And so the doctor told me that it was safe and he was approved and my mom was okay with it. She trusted my judgment and the doctor's judgment. And so I said, okay, go ahead. And so he got put on a 5-day course of remdesivir. They also, at my request, gave him very low dose of vitamin C, D3, and zinc, but it was a very, I think it was more of a get her to stop asking thing than actually a good treatment amount. I asked for higher doses. He said, my dad was willing to sign anything he needed to sign. We were willing because we didn't see any risk with giving him more vitamins and supplements. We figured it could only help. They refused. But overall, for the first couple of days, he was doing okay. He went from the nasal cannula to the rebreather, the mask. And then at night, he was on a CPAP mask. And then he slowly got worse to where he had to be on basically the CPAP mask all day and a BiPAP at night. So he would basically have as much help breathing as possible from an outside mask source. He was in good spirits. He's been through a lot. And so it wasn't the worst thing he's been through. He said it's not like times that he's been through, had several blood clots in his lungs, several strokes. He's been through more pain, but he said it was really hard because, the feeling of I can't breathe is very scary, not only wearing down your body, but emotionally, mentally. And so I think that was really hard on him. We called him multiple times a day. I sent in an extra long phone cord so that he could easily FaceTime with my mom and me and my sister, my kids, anybody he wanted to, because to him, family was everything. I mean, his free time was spent with family or sitting outside reading. That's all he loved in life is being around his people. And so we knew that that was really important. And the nurses understood that. So in between us calling the nurses, we called dad and talked to him. My kids sang Jesus Loved Me every night to him. And he loved that. We sent in some pictures of them and they colored some pictures and they hung it on his walls so he could look at that. But he was just really, really struggling. Things were just because of his past lung damage from Agent Orange, from his strokes and from all of that. It was just, his body wasn't able to rest enough to be able to heal. And they tried laying him prone flat on his belly to try and take some of that work off his muscles and his lungs. Helped a little bit, not a lot, and he hated it. And they tried some diuretics to try and get some fluid off. They tried all kinds of different things, all while giving the remdesivir. And then it got to the point where one day the doctor called me, and he told me that he needed to vent him. And he said, he's getting to the point where this is the only option. Like, his lungs just weren't healthy enough to begin with to heal without it. And he said that he thinks that it will really do him a lot of good.
And was he still, was he still in the remdesivir treatment? Was he still do that, or had he finished that?
At that point, he had just, I think he had just finished that, or a couple days prior to. So he told me that this was going to be, said he's going on the vent one way or another. He says it's either going to be an emergency situation, where the desperate attempt to save him, or it's going to be we do this now when he's struggling, have him struggle and suffer for it. And so we said, okay, you know, obviously we don't want him to struggle and suffer. And I was on a FaceTime with my dad right before he allowed, I think my sister just talked to him right before, my niece and I called, and, there wasn't enough time for my mom to call. And we just told him we love him, you know, trust the doctors. And they were all in the room, the respiratory therapist, the doctor, everyone. And they said, okay, it's time to say goodbye. And so we said goodbye and just kind of fell apart. We had no idea what was going to happen. I mean, for all we knew, that was it. And he went on the vent the weekend of August 1st. So he was admitted to the hospital on July 22nd. So it had been, about 8 or 9 days. He was on the vent for the weekend, and the doctor said, we're going to keep him on all weekend. And just kind of let his lungs rest, let his body rest, let him heal. And then Monday, we'll come in, and there's tests that they can run to see how he would do without it and wean him off of it. And he ended up doing really good on the tests. And they were able to pull him off of the vent. And they were really happy with his progress, his oxygen stability. All of that. My dad was awake and happy, and he was trying to eat. He was a little bit loopy, which I guess is typical side effects after coming off the vent, with the drugs they put you on, and just being essentially kind of in a coma for a while. They said that was normal and it'll probably go away. But he was super happy. He was starting PT. He couldn't tell what time it was because he had he was sharing a room with someone else. Mm-hmm. And so he couldn't see outside, from where he was. So he called me and my sister at 2, 3, 4 in the morning, just ready to chat for an hour. And, we were happy too, because we were happy. He was off the vent and he was doing well. He was on just the nasal cannula under the nose during the day. And the doctors were really happy with how he was doing. They said they took him for, CAT scans and x-rays, and they said his lungs are still pretty damaged. His labs aren't the greatest, but overall we're happy with how he's doing. Like, he came off the vent, he is breathing better, retaining oxygen better. They said that's a great sign. And so we're all kind of resting easy, figuring, as the doctor said, that it would be a long road to recovery and he might be in the hospital for a while longer, maybe at a rehab after, but like, things were looking up and we were happy. I was recovered. My mom was recovered. You know, my husband being deployed was very relieved. Just one less thing to worry about back home. Right. Still worried about him, but a lot less stress. But during that time, they had a lot of traveling nurses, because, you know, everybody was calling in the nurses and calling in extra doctors and anybody who could help. And so they had one particular traveling nurse. My dad did not like her. He told me one time we were on the phone and he says, "I haven't eaten all day today." And it was dinner time or past dinner. And I said, "Why not?" And he said, "Because they bring the food and they set it on the tray, but I'm too weak to eat it." And the nurse said, "It's below her pay grade to be able to feed me, that I need to just eat." And he said, I can't. He was so weak. He couldn't get the spoon to his mouth. It was just too much after everything he'd been through. And she finally went in there and fed him. I believe it was the next day. He was supposed to be on nasal cannula only during the day for a short time while he could tolerate it, and then back either on the rebreather or the CPAP, and definitely on the CPAP or BiPAP at night, just to give his lungs a chance to rest and heal. And as he wasn't ready for the nasal cannula altogether, he wasn't strong enough. But this nurse kept him on the nasal cannula all night one night. And then when the morning shift came in, nurses familiar with him, they immediately switched him because they knew he was struggling. They knew that's not what he needed. And they let me know that, you know, because of this, he's going to be on CPAP all day now and maybe BiPAP because his lungs were struggling because they had to work so hard all day and all night.
Right. Wow.
And so we were really frustrated with her. And we also, during the same time, his phone got switched to airplane mode. After the fact, we looked at his phone and he had tried calling all of us over a dozen, two dozen times and couldn't get it to connect. We couldn't connect to him. Every time we called the nurse's station, they just said that he was sleeping, or they would check his phone when they went in for rounds or meds, but it was too much work to go in and look at his phone to put on all the PPE that they had to do. And they had other people to care for because he wasn't the sickest patient on the floor, that they would get to him if they remembered when they went in. But that evening, one of our favorite night nurses went in and he said that he noticed it was on airplane mode, and he immediately turned it off and called us on FaceTime and said, you know, "Sorry that this happened." So we finally got to talk to him, and he was struggling more. They had to stop the PT because his lungs were just so worn out for the last couple of days. And then the doctor had called me and told me that at one point during the last few days, whatever days it was, my dad had a history of blood clots in his lungs, all from Agent Orange, and he was on blood thinners. And due to COVID and all the other medications, remdesivir, he had put a stop to that, and he was monitoring his INR, which is the thinness of his blood, very carefully to keep it where it needed to be. So every day he was reevaluating, giving him some meds or none. And he had an order for no medication unless the doctor was there and said, "Go get this," and he would give it to them. And just to be overly cautious, which we really appreciated, because we didn't want him to have any blood clots or other issues on top of this. But I don't know if it was the same nurse or if it was someone else. They ignored that order and they gave him a higher dose, which made his levels were supposed to be around 2.5 or 3, and they went up to 10, over 10, which meant his blood was very, very thin, or thick. I don't remember the direction. I'm sorry, but it was not a good thing. And the doctor was very concerned. A couple days or the next day or something, he went and, they did a scan and he had grown a clot in his lungs. And he said, "I think it's from that." But you know, we weren't sure. They said, you know, there's a lot of people that are getting COVID that they're getting blood clots. It wasn't until later that I, realized that there was a lot of patients on remdesivir that were also getting blood clots.
Sounds like a lot of negligence happening at this hospital.
Yes. And we weren't allowed in. We were only allowed to talk to them during the doctor during certain times. They wouldn't answer certain questions.
Right.
So that was really hard, knowing that hospital was the scariest place in the world for my dad. And we had always been with him. It was either me going to appointments with him, my mom, when my sister was around, she lived away from us, but when she was around, she would be there. And we were always, someone was always with him as often as we could be. And so knowing that we were not allowed, we requested it. They said, absolutely not. We said, we'll wear whatever PPE you want. We will sign any waivers. We will take tests showing you that we're negative. Like, we'll do whatever you want. You can move him to a special room. We'll stand behind a wall of glass. We don't care. Like, let us come in so he can see that we're there. But it got refused from the director of the hospital or somebody in some office who wasn't a caregiver. But he was just, he absolutely not, didn't care. And so he was really struggling with that. And then his heart started having issues. His heart rate was elevated between like 110 and 120s. And they couldn't get it to drop. They tried giving him different medications. Nothing was really working. And so they called in his cardiologist, who had just performed the stent right before he got COVID. That's what he had a procedure done. He had a stent in his heart. And he came in, talked to my mom. They made this decision to shock him. And basically just to try and get his heart back to a regular rhythm. His cardiologist says it's something we do. It's perfectly safe. We just kind of barely sedate him. We shock him. It should go in regular rhythm and he should be fine. And then we bring him out of it and then he'll be able to continue to heal. And so we said, okay, we trusted his cardiologist completely. He was one of the people that we knew we could take his word. And to this day, he never once said any lie or untruth to us. And we trust that everything he did was on par. Mm-hmm. But he did that. He got back down to a natural resting rhythm. But there's no explanation at the time as to why his heart was suddenly having issues. They were also saying that his kidneys were starting to fail, that the numbers were looking not good for that. And just overall, his body was failing. During that time frame, we got a new doctor, because they switched off every 3 weeks from being assigned to the COVID unit. The new doctor was very kind, but he had a very heavy accent. So when I tried to communicate with him, get answers, it just created an issue because either he didn't understand me very well or I didn't understand him. So it was frustrating being my dad at this critical level of care and knowing that, you know, everybody raved about this doctor. He's a great doctor, but just being not allowed with my dad, then also having that communication barrier with the doctor was very frustrating. It definitely just added another layer of stress and struggle. Right. And I know it was hard for my dad because he was already stressed and struggling. Just with trying to fight to stay alive, and he couldn't understand his doctor. And so I'd have to talk to the doctor and then call my dad or tell the nurses, like, can you explain to my dad? Because he just couldn't mentally process everything that was being said. They ended up putting, and I guess before they had put a central line in his neck, and they said that they wanted to do it again. Just because, they said it would be ease of medicine. If there was an emergency, things with his heart, anything like that, since he was already looking bad, they wanted to do that, again. So they went in and they put that in and they had taken an x-ray and they took COVID tests and he had tested negative for COVID at that point.
How long after he had arrived in the hospital did they test him at that time?
I think that was like the 10th or 12th of August. I think it was right before that. Cause he passed on August 14th. So it was within like 3 or 4 days before that, but before they ran the test right before he, got put on the vent again. And I think they ran it again as well when he was under the second time, but they tested, they said it was negative. And they looked at the blood clot. They said that they didn't see any others, but it had moved a little bit. And they wanted to keep an eye on it, but there wasn't a lot they could do, because of medications he was on, the condition he was in, and all of that. It was basically, you know, wait and see if he recovers, and hopefully it'll break up on its own, or we can do more when he gets a little better. So really it was just waiting and praying and trusting that they would, do everything that they could. And he just continued to decline, during those days after the nurse did not oxygenate him properly. Just from that point forward, there was no, he's doing better today. It was every day something else was added. The heart thing, oxygen levels, stopping PT, everything that was looking so great just started going downhill.
No, that's, I'm just hearing this is so frustrating to think that he was doing so well. And then you have this one nurse come in, not, you know, not giving him the proper treatment or what was working for him. And, you know, thinking that might have been what set him over the edge and yeah, set him back again. So it's very frustrating. I can't.
It is.
I think it happens a lot in hospitals, you know, and I can't believe that it continues to happen. So many people have been experiencing this type of thing, this, I think, negligence for years in hospital settings. And it keeps happening and it's very frustrating. And I feel really bad for your dad and for you and your family and for what you've been going through.
And I think, yeah, for us, it was really hard to see, but also I think for my dad, it was just, you know, he was doing well, he was feeling better, and then it just hit him again. And I think at that point, I want to say that, I don't want to say he had given up, but I feel like he knew the way he talked to us. And of course he was tired and, you know, wasn't oxygenating well and all that. But I could just kind of see it in his eyes when I talked to him that he was just like not done, but sad and why and like scared. And because of his PTSD, the best thing that he always that helped him, that my mom would always do or one of us would always do if he was in the hospital, if he was having a panic attack or anything, is easiest thing to calm him down was just to hold his hand and talk to him and say, we're here. It's okay. You can calm down. Because that feeling scared and alone was a big trigger. And some of the nurses were willing to do that. Like they put him on the vent the first time. And then when they did the heart shock, I just asked, you know, can someone just stand there? And you have to be there anyways. Can you just hold his hand? Like, and just let him know it's okay. We can't be there. You won't let us be there. We're fighting to be there and you're forcing him to be alone. The least you can do is try and help. They said they would. I don't know if they ever did. I trust that some of the nurses that we loved did. They were very loving and very caring. But it just was going downhill too fast. Kidneys failing, numbers, labs dropping, like things weren't looking so good anymore. My sister's worked in doctor's offices and clinics for decades, and she, I didn't know what every lab meant, but she was asking about certain things, and she's just like, those aren't good numbers. She's like, I'm not a doctor, but those aren't good. We asked the nurses and doctors, and they just said, you know, we're doing everything we can, or we can't do anything at this point, or, you know, it wasn't really, I didn't feel as if anybody was fighting, like they were sad and they sympathized that with us, that we had to be away from him. They were sad that he was sick and alone and they would try and be with him. And then there was several nurses that You know, they would just do their best within what they were allowed to do, but nobody was really willing to step up and fight. And so there was one night where we were on the phone with him. My mom and dad's anniversary is actually August 9th. So he got to talk to her then. And we had been taking up, dropping smoothies off in the hospital lobby, and they would take it up to the COVID unit, his favorite smoothies, just to give him something else. He couldn't always drink it or have the appetite. One time he was too weak and it spilled on him, but, you know, we couldn't really do a lot for him. So that's what we did. We sent that up to him. Me and my mom talked on their anniversary. He wasn't doing great, but wasn't too bad. But I believe it was the next day we called to say goodnight, and the kids called to sing their bedtime songs to pop up. And then afterward, the he was on BiPAP, and afterward the nurse took the phone and looked at it, and one of the good nurses, and he said, I'm going to get him situated. I'm going to walk out to the nurse institution. I'm going to call you. So I'm going to call you back in like 5 minutes. So be by your phone. I said, okay. And about 5 minutes later, he called me and he said, he's not doing good. He says, they want to put him on the vent again. He's struggling. His numbers are dropping. His kidneys are struggling. He is not doing good at all. And we need to do this right now. The respiratory therapist is on his way up. The ER doctor is on the way up. The nighttime hospitalist is coming. We got some nurses coming in. And he says, we're doing this. I wanted to let you know that this is what's happening. And he says, we don't have a choice. This is what we have to do. And he said, I'll call you when it's done. He said, last time, as you know, it took about 15, 20 minutes. He said, so I'll call you. And I waited and I waited. This was like at 1 in the morning. When I finally called back, and it had been a couple hours. I'd called back different times and they said, they're still in there with them. You know, they know that they're going to call you. And, I said, he's not gone. Is he? And the nurse said, no. She said, I'm going to let the people that have been working with him call you when they're done, but they're with him right now and they can't leave him. And I said, okay. And so about 1 in the morning, 2 in the morning, they called and they said, we're sorry it's been so long. But this whole time we've been bagging him. They placed the vent, but he wasn't stabilizing on it. And so they worked for a couple hours. They finally, she said, I have to go back in there. We think we got him stable, but I need to go back in there. We're not going to leave his side until we're 100% assured that he is stable. So they were in with him for probably 3 or 4 hours, the nurses and the respiratory therapists, doctors. They got him back on the vent. And before all that happened, my sister and my mom were both able to call briefly and just say, I love you and good night and, all of that. So this time my mom got to say that, and knowing it was the second time of the event and things were going wrong, part of us, for all of us, it was like worry, because second time on the event isn't good, but also, well, he was already on the vent, so he'll rest for a few days and he'll be fine.
Right.
And we hadn't known that he had tested negative for COVID yet. They didn't tell us until after the fact, after he was on the vent. But he was on the vent for 4 days. His cardiologist came and checked on him. My mom asked the cardiologist, you know, what are you willing to do for him? And he said, we will pound on his chest until you tell us to quit. Like, we will not give up on him. He said, if I'm there, I will not give up on him. And so my mom was, you know, really assured that she had a good cardiologist. The hospitalist, daytime hospitalist, was overall a good doctor, just hard with the communication. And at that point, they all said that it was too late for any other treatments, that nothing else would work, even if, you know, they were willing to give it to him. He was past that point. And so now it was just waiting to see if his body rested long enough to come off the vent. And the hospitalists would talk to me and tell me, you know, his plan was that because he was going to be negative for COVID, once he got stable enough and off the vent, he says he might have to be on a more permanent vent for a while and go to a rehab facility. He said it could be a couple months there. And he was, you know, he said, I found one about an hour from you guys. Like, he was making these plans.
Mm-hmm. Very optimistic.
Very much so, which caused all of us to be optimistic. Like, he's talking about rehab. Yeah, he might have to have, you know, the trach in for help breathing for a while, but he'd be alive. And that's all we cared about. And they were monitoring the blood clot. And at one point, he called and he said, the morning of the 14th, he said, he's not doing very good. He's really, really struggling. He said he had a hard night. They were in there a lot with him, struggling that morning. And he wanted to take him back and do a CAT scan of his lungs and see how his lungs were healing and how his the blood clot was doing, and just kind of be able to get an assessment to see if there's anything more they could do or anything else they could tell. It was at that point that he told me he tested negative for COVID. So that wasn't like their concern anymore. And I said, well, he's not doing so good. I said, this was earlier in the morning. I said, is there any way my mom could go in? Not anybody else, but my mom, because if he's not doing good, you know, right, she should at least be able to go in and be with him for a little while. Right.
And he's say, tested I love for you. COVID, tested negative for COVID.
Right. And he had put in an inquiry to move him to a different unit, a respiratory unit, not a COVID unit, because he was negative. So ICU respiratory unit, and said, well, if he gets over there, then she might be able to. He put in a request. They said he couldn't be moved and my mom couldn't come. This was once again from the bureaucrats at the hospital. They didn't care. It was just a no. And he called me. That was around 8 or 9 that morning. He called me around 11 or noon, and he said that they were gonna take him back and do the CT scan. When they were done, that they would give me a call. And so I was just resting and praying and waiting. My mom, everybody knew what was happening. My husband, which he was 9 hour time difference from us at that point, and he was staying up waiting to see what they found out. And my phone rang and he called me and he said, we were on the way and your dad had a heart attack. So they're doing CPR on him right now in the hallway. Says, I think what happened is the blood clot dislodged in his, went to his heart and caused a heart attack. And he said, I need to know if you want us to continue. And I said, like, call it? He said, yes. And I said, well, what happens if you keep going? He said, even if we get him back from this, his body's failing, his kidneys are failing. And he says, he's not going to come back from this. He said, so we'll keep going and we can try and stabilize him, but it's going to keep happening and he's not going to pull through. And I said, well, I can't make that call to end it without talking to my mom. So I called my mom and I don't think she really grasped what I was saying.
Mm-hmm.
I told her what happened and I said, do you want them to keep going? And she said, no, he shouldn't suffer. And she was just oddly calm. And that's what, thinking back, I think that she might not have understood or just understood, but it hadn't quite hit her what it fully meant. Right. So I called back and I said, no, I said, don't continue. It's going to happen one way or another, today or tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Like, don't do this.
Right.
And he said, okay, I'm sorry for your loss. We'll be in contact. And he hung up. And that was it. And I had to call my mom. And then I called my husband and told him. And I had him call my sister. I said, I can't call everybody. I told my mom because, you know, we were just on the phone and it hit her really hard. And I think at that point she realized what my phone call right before that meant. And so that hit her really hard and didn't seem real. And I told my husband and I said, you need to call my sister, because she was going to be the one to call Red Cross to get him to come home. I said, but I can't be the one that tells everyone. I had to have the doctor tell me, and I had to make that call with the help of my mom. So I can't do that. He called her, and that was it. My sister was on her way back from taking my niece, dropping her off at college for the first time, and they had to pull over, and it was just hit us really hard, because we were getting so much reassurance from the doctors about rehab and all of this. And we went through the process of the viewing and planning the funeral and all of this stuff. And I talked to the doctor and I asked about the death certificate. I said, what is it going to say? And I said, is it going to say he died of COVID? Because I said, he tested negative. Mm-hmm. He said, no, he's not going to put that it'll be on one of the causes, because they have like four or five lines. He said, but he died of the
blood clot,
pulmonary embolism that moved to his heart and caused the heart attack. And then after all of that, I got the death certificate. My husband came home from, he got emergency leave for a couple weeks to come home and help us with the funeral service and handling all of his affairs and all of that. And I requested his medical documents, and I got everything. And everything that they did was in there. You can clearly see where the doctor said, I mean, it's thousands of pages, and I scoured, I haven't read everything, but where he put in the order for no medicine for the blood thinners, where he was left on the nasal cannula. I mean, all of these things are there, but in a way that it makes it seem like that's just what they did. And it wasn't.
It wasn't an actual cause of something.
It wasn't a cause that the remdesivir didn't have any effect on him. And that basically he was just had so many other conditions that, you know, the COVID is what just took him over the edge. And after the last year of reading about what the remdesivir does, kidney failures, with the heart problems, with being more prone to blood clots, and then with the malpractice that went through, I just look back and I'm just like, if my dad would have received the proper care and he would have never gotten remdesivir, I can't say for sure, but I wonder if he would still be with us.
Yeah. Well, I mean, sick people do recover too. You know, I think hospitals, it really bothers me the way they try to make it out as if, you know, because you have all of these pre-existing conditions that you just have no fighting chance. And that's just not the case. People pull through all the time. And I think that, you know, unfortunately in your case and in your father's case, it was just a complete lack of the right information. You know, you couldn't make an informed decision because you didn't have all the answers. And to be honest with you, I think a lot of these doctors don't either. If you look back at everything that happened last year and all the cases of all the people who have passed away with COVID, and I say that because I don't believe that most people died of COVID. I personally believe that they died with COVID or, you know, ended up in the hospital on these ventilators and on these protocols like remdesivir, which ultimately, end up killing people. But all of these hospitals around the world are following the same protocols, and not just with the medication, the treatments, but also how things are handled regarding visitations with families. I think one of the biggest things for people in the recovery, and I think it's so important, that the emotional support that someone gets in a hospital setting is so vital to their recovery. You know, I don't know if you've ever been in the hospital, but when you're laying there and you're hearing all of the dings and the bells, and you're around all these other sick people and you're completely isolated, it's a really awful feeling. And being isolated, we know the psychology behind that, really has an effect on your overall health. And I really do think that that's this, whatever this protocol these hospitals have been following in regards to the visitations with families and, you know, forcing patients to die in their long, die alone, excuse me, is criminal. It's criminal. It's disgusting.
I totally agree. And especially with, I mean, and I don't, I understand why at the time there's a lot of people very scared, but when it comes down to it, when my dad's willing to take the risk, when we're willing to take the risk, we're willing to do anything they ask just to go in, and they know that there's lots of studies on, you know, that human connection and being able to recover with support and with people you love versus on your own, and the fact that it wasn't even doctors making the decisions. Mm-hmm. It was people from the top that just, they didn't care what was happening to my dad. They didn't care his history of PTSD. They didn't care that he was mentally and emotionally struggling because he was on his own. I told them, I said, you guys don't understand. Like, he was in his truck in the parking lot and I was on the phone with him and I had to beg him to go inside because he wasn't wanting to, because he was afraid you would do exactly what you did, you're doing, and keep him away from his family and thing that he knows is what will get him through. And he'd been through surgeries and strokes and treatments and months in the hospital ever since I can remember. And I think he had always, even though he'd been through a lot of hard times and faced other malpractice issues and just lack of trust in the care, the consistent thing was when he had compassionate care providers that knew the value of having, letting him have my mom there or one of us there.
Right.
And then to have that whole day where he just ignored him, they wouldn't fix his phone for him. And when my mom was going through his phone, she showed me, she's like, look at all these calls that he tried to call us on the day that we thought, you know, something is wrong with his phone, or maybe he's just not feeling well or whatever. We couldn't figure it out, to see that he had tried so desperately almost 24 times to call all of us and he couldn't get it to work. And they just didn't care. Like, if you know that you're not letting us in, your number one priority that should be to make sure we have a way to do that.
Was it like, when you were explaining that to me, that his phone was put on airplane mode, I couldn't help but to wonder if that was done intentionally by someone else, or do you know if he accidentally
I know that due to his issues with the stroke, sometimes he would do something, and we thought that maybe those issues with the stroke and then coming off the vent and having all of that, would be, maybe that had something to do with it. He pushed the wrong button, he was confused, but it's definitely crossed my mind with, we knew how one or two nurses were treating him especially, and it wasn't good. There's a couple of nurses that I would call and they didn't really care to answer any of my questions. Like, they wanted to get off the phone, they had other things to do. And so part of me wonders if one of these nurses who was, she didn't want to feed him, she didn't want to do any of that, they didn't care to go and check on him, he had to call and ask for food and beg for food several times.
That's just disgusting. Some of these
people that,
that's so sad. Know,
maybe they did that so that they could just ignore it, because they knew that the more we knew and the more he told us, that we were going to call him, we were going to fight for him. We had the direct line to the nurse's station, but we didn't. We were never rude. We were always understanding. We sent 4 or 5 gift baskets and thank you cards of snacks and treats for the nurses during his stay there, which was a little over 3 weeks. Like, we made sure to let them and the doctors know, like, we know it's not a perfect situation and we don't expect you to be perfect. We appreciate what you're doing for my dad and for others. And so it was never like, it wasn't anything that we did. Don't know if some of them were just tired and burnt out, if they were just people that just didn't care. They were lazy. I don't know, but it's definitely crossed my mind.
Well, yeah, it's definitely nothing that you did. There's no amount of anything that can convince me that you or your family did anything wrong. I keep thinking back to what you were saying earlier about this nurse. You were saying like people weren't fighting for him. And that's one thing for me as well that I think in hospitals lately are lacking, the fact that these medical professionals aren't fighting for their patients. You know, if, you know, we put ourselves in each other's shoes, this is the way it's supposed to be. If you're a medical professional, you're a doctor, you're a nurse taking care of someone, I would try to put myself in their shoes. And you want someone to fight for your loved one. You want someone to fight for you. And not just advocating, but like, you know, these doctors have a responsibility. You know, if they're putting people on these medications and following these protocols, to really inform themselves and not just to go with what they're being told from the top.
Right.
So I hold them accountable for everything that's been going on in the last nearly 2 years now, with all of these people who've passed away last year with COVID. It's amazing to see. I don't know what state your dad was in.
Texas.
He was in Texas. I'm here in New York. And the number of stories that I've heard of that just sound so familiar and aligned with what you're telling me, it's like, you can't make this stuff up. How is it that all of these people in New York and Texas around the world are experiencing the same exact thing? They're, you know, the doctors are basically saying the same thing by the book. You know, oh, well, the protocols and, you know, the orders are coming from higher up. Okay. Where are these higher ups getting their information from? You know, how is it that all of these hospitals in Italy, in the UK, here in America, why are they all aligning with each other and following the same exact protocol? And then people see that this protocol is not working.
And they continue, your letter, they're still doing it.
And they're still doing it. Mm-hmm. They're still doing it. It's just crazy. And I can't, you know, I don't know what it was like in Texas where you live, but I've seen when my mother was in the hospital last year, you know, they were trying to say that all the hospitals were overwhelmed with COVID patients and you know, they were working to the bone. And I'm for those doctors and nurses who generally do care, I don't want to take anything away from that. But I was at a very big hospital when my mother was there. And there was not one person in the emergency department when I arrived there, when she got taken there. And I was fortunate enough to see her leading up until her death. When she went in, she did not have COVID. And I was fortunate enough to see her, but I did see that the hospital was empty, even on the floors. When I was moving in between floors, when I was taking the elevator, when I was in the parking garage, I was taking note of those things. They were empty. And yeah, I know that this was the case here in New York as well. You know, they were trying to make it out like the bodies were piling up in these cooler vans out here, and they were completely understaffed. But the reality was, from my point of view and from others, was that the ambulances were all parked outside the hospital, not being used. And the people who were dying from being put on ventilators and things like remdesivir. So either a lack of bad treatment or no treatment at all. Because I was just going to say, most of the people who died were dying in the hospital settings. They weren't dying at home.
Right. And, you know, that's what I noticed when my dad went in for his procedure a couple weeks before. It wasn't crazy busy. I had gone in to an appointment and it was just completely dead. When I went and got tested at a military clinic, I was the only one there. When I went to drop off his stuff in ER for his phone charger, the smoothies we would take him, there's nobody in there. Mm-hmm. And when I asked about like moving him to a separate room, because we wanted to, said, can you try budesonide that might help? They said they wouldn't move him because it was too much work to get him to a room with the right vent system or something. They said, because it would just spread COVID over the hospital if he wasn't in the right room. I don't even quite understand. They weren't even willing to try, but they, I said, well, don't you have those rooms? They're like, yeah, we have them. But that whole part, one wing of the hospital was closed. So they only had one small section. They said, we don't have anything in our section. Yeah. We're not allowed to use that.
They had a whole entire wing of a hospital closed. They were overwhelmed that the bodies were piling up, but they closed half the hospital.
That's what the, one of the main nurses told me. They said, we have that whole part closed off. And they had other departments closed down too. And they said, you know, we're limited in certain things of what we can do because things are shut down. And so it was very frustrating to not only feel like they weren't fighting for him, but that the resources that they could have had open, mm-hmm. not only for him, but for anybody else, they were just like, no, we're not even going to try. We're just going to close.
Right.
So that's not an option for you.
Right. At what point were, you know, did you, or when did you realize once this happened, once your father passed, and you had a moment to kind of digest what had happened, like when did you start to feel like, okay, well, maybe this was the remdesivir, maybe the ventilator, maybe, you know, that combined with the fact that there was some obvious neglect, I think, in that hospital.
So pretty much right away, that's why we requested the medical records right away, that we knew that there was some malpractice, whether it would be able to be filed under malpractice, we haven't gotten that far yet. But we knew that things didn't happen the way they should. So we knew that hurt. We can't be for certain, with our limited knowledge, without mm-hmm. pursuing it further, if that was a big factor. But I think in the last 6 to 8 months, with people coming out, talking more about remdesivir, mm-hmm. the studies coming out with people like Nicole Sirotek and all these people fighting to keep people off remdesivir. They're getting people that the hospitals have on vents that say they have a couple days and they're gone. We're not doing anything else. Mm-hmm. And they're getting them out of there. I've just been realizing more and more in the last few months that things they're saying that the remdesivir does, the kidney failure, the problems with the heart, the mm-hmm. blood clots, they go from doing really well to just doing so bad and their body's completely
very
failing.
Very quickly.
Like knowing that the first 5 days, 4 or 5 days my dad was in there before he got the remdesivir, and then the few days after the first few doses, like he was doing okay. We knew it might be a long recovery, but after mm-hmm. reading what I'm reading, I'm like, this is exactly what they're saying would have happened. And within 3 weeks, he was mm-hmm. gone. And like, I know he had other issues. He already had issues with having to take blood thinners and issues with his lungs, but he didn't have kidney issues. He didn't mm-hmm. really have any heart issues that were concerning. To that point, it was all like very suddenly he had all of these crazy issues, and from a respiratory virus, like that just doesn't make sense. I had it. I recovered fine. My mom recovered perfectly fine. My niece had it. my husband ended up testing for T-cell antibodies and realized that he had had it. He had thought he was just tired for a couple of weeks from being quarantined in a dark room with no windows and time change. And he realizes, I think I had COVID the same time you guys did.
Wow.
So we were all fine and recovered. And given we didn't have as many health issues as he did, mm-hmm. but for him to go in for, I have trouble breathing, so my kidneys are failing, my heart's, I had a heart attack, I'm getting blood clots. To me, I think if we are able to pursue it further, to look into it further and have someone look at it from not just a more policy or political or whatever standpoint, but just an unbiased look at the facts and look at the side effects of everything that was given to him and see if he would mm-hmm. fit that. I really believe that the malpractice and the remdesivir combined is what he lost his life to, and it wasn't COVID.
Did your family opt to get a autopsy done?
No, it was never offered to us.
Of course not.
They basically said he's down in the morgue. You need to call a funeral home. Like all that day he died, you need to call mm-hmm. a funeral home, or we can call one for you. And it was never offered. And I mean, being in such shock and just emotional state, I had thought about it, but mm-hmm. I was just like, I wasn't sure if it had to be offered, if you can mm-hmm. demand those things. And I didn't know if we had any way to fight for it with the little information we had at the time. Right. Looking back now, I would have loved to been like, will you do an autopsy at least to get these samples for future? But we didn't, and he was moved to the funeral home and cremated. So we don't even have that option now as a future thing.
Has your family started, have you filed anything yet in regards to malpractice suit?
No, my husband and I really want to. I'm not really sure if what my mom would think about that. I know that we are the ones that are really invested in this, and we read all about it. I mean, this is consuming our life right now in one way or another. And so we would love to move forward with that, but and it's something we want to do, but haven't, besides the initial mentioning it to my mom, but it's obviously too soon. Right mm-hmm. after he passed, we haven't brought it up again. So it's definitely something we want to look into, but I don't even know where to begin with that, or if it would even go anywhere, seeing as, you know, they're still doing the same things. They're still saying mm-hmm. things are caused the same way and that they're doing nothing wrong. Protocols are all the same. So I don't know if it would even go anywhere.
Right. This is, as I said in the beginning of our conversation today, there's, I wasn't familiar with your story. So it was a surprise, to have you come on here and talk about your dad's story being an actual COVID/remdesivir case. And I really empathize with you because I see similarities in what you went through with your dad and what I went through with my mom. And I think, you know, having these conversations, we have to continue to have them and bring more awareness because there are so many people out there like you and like myself who've gone through this and who are still going through this. This has to stop. I can't tell you how many families I've heard this from. I'm sure over the last, year or so since you've been looking at all of this, you've seen many other stories just like yourself. Obviously, this is why
almost identical.
We're having this conversation, and people really need to wake up and realize what's happening. And for all of those medical professionals out there who are, working these cases and taking care of patients in these settings, they really need to start looking at what's going on and questioning things. It is their duty, their responsibility. This is the oath that they've signed when they've, you know, when they've come on with this career to do no harm. But in doing no harm, that means that you have to do your due diligence too. You can't just follow a protocol, because not every protocol fits everybody. Everyone's circumstances and everyone's health is completely different. And what works for one person might not work for another.
I'll tell them, like, okay, you're doing this for other people, but my dad is different and he has these other issues. And if anything, there's the PTSD factor and all of that. Mm-hmm. And they just didn't seem to care. And I think that after all of this, I always tell people, they say, oh, it must have been the hardest thing you ever did to lose your dad. I said, absolutely. And they said, how did you go through the grief process? And I said, I don't think I have. Mm-hmm. I think that I had that initial shock and the sadness, but I don't often get emotional when talking about it, because mm-hmm. I feel like I don't have the answers that mm-hmm. I want, and I don't have medical professionals being honest, and the ones that are mm-hmm. obviously aren't allowed to speak up or do anything, and they lose their positions. And so I feel like I can't fully grieve him until we have some answers and some honesty, mm-hmm. not only with what happened to him, but what's happening to so many others. And anytime I hear of somebody getting COVID or going to the hospital, I say, stay away from remdesivir. Mm-hmm. I said, I can't prove it right now, but I've seen so many people. We had a friend that went in the hospital a month or two after my dad, friend's husband, and he passed away. He had remdesivir. It was a much quicker decline for him, but mm-hmm. everything was so similar. And I feel like until there are some answers or some resolve, like, can't fully grieve his death, because mm-hmm. to me, there's still so much left to resolve from that. And it just sucks that there are some people, you know, I know death happens and you lose people, and I've lost people before. And it was really easy to come to terms with, you know, they were sick or they were in an accident right. or whatever. And, you know, this is what's surrounding their death. And we know what it caused or what caused it. And we have to go through that process and then move forward. And I obviously have to move forward. I have 3 kids, my husband, I have a lot going on in our own lives, but to stop and grieve him, I don't have any of the answers to my questions, and more keeps coming out that makes me go, wait a second. You know, it's just reaffirming right. that something wasn't right. And sometimes I wish that it was clear cut. Like, if he was going to be gone anyways, that it was very clear what had happened.
Right.
That we had, that something else went wrong, or I don't know. Like, yeah. It sounds silly to say that you wish that he would have died a different way, so it would have just been mm-hmm. easier, but you know, I don't have those answers, and I don't know if I ever will. And I know my mom is going through some grief counseling classes, and my sister and nieces have all done the way that they need to do. But I know for me, and even for my husband, he and my husband were very close, that we still feel like there's a fight to be had, and there's answers that we don't have. And right. I hope that one day we can do that, so we can finally move past his death and just get to the good memories, instead of always right. have that what happened
lingering. Well, I mean, I'm so sorry that you and your family have gone through this. I'm so sorry for your dad, especially knowing that he went through all of those other things with the military. And you know, that's hard. These military veterans suffer for so long. And then in the end, you know, you would hope that the system would give them the treatment that they need, and also the treatment that they deserve. I hope that you and your family are able to find the answers that you need. I hope that you get the justice that you deserve for your dad. You know, I hope that you're able to find peace with his passing. You know, when you start going through your grieving process, I really feel for you and your family. It makes me feel very emotional hearing what you went through, and just knowing that there are so many others out there going through this still. It needs to stop. But Rebecca, I you know, I want to thank you for coming on here and sharing your father's story. Hopefully others out there will hear this and will come forward, and people will start to put the pieces of the puzzle together and to kind of connect the dots. But I always like to ask, you know, at the end of our interviews, if there's anything that you feel that the listeners out there need to hear, if there's anything that you want to share.
I think my biggest takeaway from this has just been the reinforcement to trust your gut and to ask questions. And there's a lot of wonderful health professionals out there, but there's a lot of them that can't just take their word for it. You have to do your own research. Doesn't matter if it's regarding COVID or the COVID vaccine or anything else, that you can't just take their word for it, because at the end of the day, we have to fight for ourselves. And we fought as hard as we could for my dad, and fighting for my husband right now. And I just think that it's something that we shouldn't have to do. We should be able to just place our trust in medical providers and trust that we'll get the best care with the best knowledge and the best informed consent, but it's not happening. So definitely be willing to fight and do your own research. Ask the hard questions and force them to answer them.
Right. Thank you, Rebecca. Appreciate you. Yeah.